You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped, first broadcast on the 9th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ. And welcome to the 15th edition of Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. Produced from our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong and Singapore, and right here at Midori House in London, this is your unmissable weekly briefing from the world's most dynamic region. Coming up on today's show, we'll look at efforts to promote Indonesia as a place ripe for investment, as President Joko Widodo struggles to attract crucial foreign funds.
Although Indonesia still is attractive as a foreign investment destination, a lot of foreign investors are now saying, well, we'll have a wait-and-see attitude. And a lot of these problems, I think, emerged because of the president and his cabinet's inexperience.
That's in part one of my studio interview with the editor of Globe Asia, Shoaib Kagda. Then we're in Sichuan, where the spicy hot pot isn't the only thing putting the region on the map.
There are heritage buildings, and particularly a temple in the heart of the project. So we have to try to find a solution to integrate all these heritage elements.
Also ahead, we'll take a sip out of Phnom Penh's growing interest in artisan coffee.
A lot of Cambodians, they are willing to try something new. They want to expose to something cool, modern, or they see it in the movie or cable channel.
And later in the show, we'll take a tour of Singapore's home for tech startups and ambitious investors. All that plus 24 hours in Auckland, right here on Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ, starting now. At the World Economic Forum earlier this year, the Indonesian president was busy showing off his country as an ideal destination for foreign investment. A $1 billion coal-fired power plant was mid-construction, demonstrating the country's ability to attract major projects. But while the power plant is due to be completed ahead of schedule next year, President Joko Widodo has had a tough time following through with his ultimate plan. Growth in Indonesia's economy is slowing, but if Widodo's goals are to be reached, the country will need to find an extra $450 billion. Shoaib Kagda is the editor of Globe Asia. On a recent trip to London, he popped into Midori House for a chat about the current state of Indonesia's economy and how diplomacy might play a key role in the country's fortunes. In the first part of our discussion, I asked Shoaib about Indonesia's attractiveness as an investment destination under the presidency of Joko Widodo.
The president, Joko Widodo, came to power on a wave of euphoria. He was seen as even a messiah to a certain extent. A lot of people had very high expectations of him. Of course, you know, 10 months into his presidency, things are not so rosy. The economy has slowed down to under 5% growth. Although Indonesia still is attractive as a foreign investment destination, a lot of foreign investors are now saying, well, we'll have a wait-and-see attitude. And a lot of these problems, I think, emerged because of the president and his cabinet's inexperience to a large extent. When he came to power, Joko Widodo made a point of saying that he would not have any minister who had been tainted by corruption, which was a very strong statement. But having said that, of course, then he had to really go beyond the usual catchment of talent to try and find his ministers. And many of these people, of course, because they were out of the system for such a long time, taking a lot longer than people expected to try and understand how government works in Indonesia, to come to grips with the bureaucracy, try to move the civil servants, and that's taking a lot longer than most people expected.
It was only earlier this year that we saw Joko Widodo at the World Economic Forum, and he was really touting Indonesia there as a place to invest. And he actually said, please come and invest in Indonesia. If you have any problem, call me. Now, of course, as you were just saying, the face of Indonesia has been changing over a number of months. Certainly in recent times, at least, there has been a diplomatic spat between Indonesia and Australia, which has been ongoing for a long time anyway and has its roots in other places, but it certainly came to the forefront fairly recently. recently. How have all of these issues affected Indonesia's global reputation?
Well, you know, under the previous president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, Indonesia's image in the world really took a sharp rise. He was seen as a global person, you know. Joko Widodo, on the other hand, has come in, and while, you know, his democratic credentials and his background as a man of the people was very widely received, I think under him, people have probably become a little bit unsure of which direction the country is taking. Is it going to be an open society? Is it going to be an open economy, which means that, you know, you allow free flow of competition, you allow, you know, free flow of ideas, and of course, allow foreign investments to come into Indonesia? Or is Indonesia going to be a more closed society? Now, there's been a lot of talk about economic nationalism, where certain sectors of the economy have been closed to foreign investors. That has created an image that Indonesia is actually going backwards under Joko Widodo. Now, I have to say that actually those are the two extremes. It's somewhere in the middle. The president is definitely a lot more nationalistic in the sense that he thinks that Indonesian companies and Indonesians should be given the opportunity to rise and to take advantage of the opportunities that are opening up as the economy grows. That doesn't mean that he is banning or, you know, restricting foreign investments into Indonesia. He's just saying that let's give Indonesians more opportunities.
Now, part of that, though, is plans for funding new infrastructure plans, which he has brought to the forefront of his presidency. But Jakarta has estimated that it will need about $450 billion worth of investment to fund those plans. That's at least getting it up to 2019. Do you really think that Indonesia's economy is in the kind of state that it can find that sort of money to fund those sorts of plans?
Well, domestically, I can tell you that 100% they don't have the funds domestically to fund that kind of infrastructure development, which means that Indonesia will need to attract large amounts of foreign investments. Out of that $450 billion figure that you mentioned, the government and the domestic capital markets can only fund 30% of that, which means 70% will have to come from abroad. Now, where does it come from? Part of it will come from private investors. Part of it will come from multilateral institutions like the ADB, the World Bank. Indonesia is reaching out to the newly formed Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which is backed by the Chinese. But to attract this money, it has to improve its domestic investment climate. Investors will only come if they feel that, first, number one, their investment is secure. And number two is that the government will not make it difficult for them to recoup their investments and make some profit on it, because there's no point them putting in money and then they find that that money is stuck, or that, you know, certain new regulations have suddenly come up which they were not expecting. Now, that is one of the biggest challenges for foreign investors. New regulations are coming out almost every other day, and many of these regulations do not harmonize with previous regulation. Sometimes even contradict previous regulations. This then creates an environment of great uncertainty.
That was Shoaib Kagda there, editor of Globe Asia. Now, diplomacy has been a key factor shaping Joko Widodo's reputation internationally. But what role might it play for the country economically? I'll discuss that with Shoaib Kagda in part two of my interview, coming up on next week's program. You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped. Up next, we'll touch down in the Chinese city of Chengdu. Now, besides a spicy hot pot and mesmerizing nature, Sichuan is a place famous for knowing how to live better and appreciate quality of life in China. Tucked away from the crowded coastal area, Chengdu is emerging as one of the continent's key cities. Partnering with Sino-Ocean Land, Swire Property has completed an ambitious project called Taikoo Li Chengdu. More like a community mixed with retail, hotel, and commercial workspace, it gives a pioneering touch to urban planning in the city. Monocle's Kurt Lin went along to meet Dr. Hao Lin, director at the Oval Partnership, who managed the design of the project.
Growing up in traditional Hutong community in Beijing, with education in Tsinghua University, Berkeley, and Cambridge, Dr. Hao Lin has completed a project in Chengdu, bridging the Eastern vision into a modern architectural community project. Here, I'm sitting at the Oval Partnership office with Dr. Hao to talk about how he gave birth to this project.
Sino-Ocean Taikoo Li Chengdu is a major project led by Swire Property and Sino-Ocean Land. And it is a major urban regeneration project in Chengdu with a large scale, with the shopping center, a temple house hotel, and the office building overall. It adopts the open city and open land concept.
In the center of Taikoo Li, there is a Da Qi temple built almost 1,000 years ago. How did they integrate modern luxury like Gucci and Cartier, as well as urban planning concepts, into an old Sichuan's neighborhood?
There are a series of heritage buildings, and particularly a temple in the heart of the project. So we have to try to find a solution to integrate all these heritage elements, not mentioning all the culture and historical merits in this site, as well as to try to design a solid urban structure to promote the business and to work well with people who are going to use the space. So I think that really the challenge is how to transform the history and the culture elements into the modern use. The open space, or the open lens altogether, is really one of the most important success factors in this project, because we found that by designing, by planning more public realm, public space, it is actually to promote the public life in modern Chinese cities. So I think public space here in the Sino-Ocean Taikoo Li Chengdu means a lot to local people and also the international visitors. For example, we have a series of urban spaces in this project that to make sure every visitor you have many things to see along your journey into this project. For example, you can always, you know, see the things like pagoda, you can always see the temple and see some of the interesting events, activities in this plaza or that lens. You can see all these heritage buildings. You can go to a wonderful Fang Suo bookstore to take a look over many, many interesting books. You can, most important, you can see different peoples here, either in the weekend or in a normal weekday. So I think this is really about the vibrant and interesting urban life here in the city.
Making good use of public space has for 1,000 years been rooted in Chinese culture, to which some may refer as feng shui. After the successful project of East meets West, how does Dr. Hao see the future of traditional Chinese architecture in the modern context?
To reflect the merit of historical and cultural elements in China is really about the transformation, rather than purely doing the replica itself. I think in the Sino-Ocean Taikoo Li Chengdu project, our understanding is that we definitely need to do a good job for the conservation and adaptive reuse. But more importantly is to use all these heritage buildings as some of the elements in the urban design. For example, to use the heritage as a gateway into the heart of the whole project.
That was Monocle's Kurt Lin there in conversation with Dr. Hao Lin. You're listening to Asia-Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. Still to come on today's show, we'll sample some Cambodian coffee, tour a tech startup space in Singapore, and we'll spend 24 hours in Auckland.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
This is is Asia-Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. Now, 10 years ago, the Cambodian city of Phnom Penh had barely a handful of Western, or some might say American-style, coffee chains, which were frequented mostly by tourists and backpackers. For Cambodians, coffee was something often enjoyed at a roadside stall, served in a tall glass over ice, sweetened with condensed milk. Well, that's all started to change in recent years, with the people of Phnom Penh embracing coffee culture in rapidly swelling numbers. It's news much to the delight of our coffee-loving contributor, Robert Carmichael, who brings us this report.
May I have you, sir?
I've come to this coffee shop in central Phnom Penh to meet a young Cambodian entrepreneur called Chang Bun Liang.
My name is Bun Liang. I'm one of the co-founders of Brown.
Brown Coffee, Bun Liang's business, is Cambodia's leading coffee shop chain, with 10 stores in Phnom Penh, and plans to nearly double that in 2 years. Naturally enough, I've met Bun Liang at a Brown Coffee outlet, in this case, the roastery, so called because it has a mini coffee roastery visible through glass windows on the ground floor. Now, when I first came to Cambodia in 2001, European-style coffee was hard to find. Phnom Penh's residents, then as now, ordered thick, heavily sweetened iced coffee from one of the city's countless noodle restaurants. That remained largely the case until Bun Liang and his well-matched co-founders, two engineers, an architect, and a designer, returned from studying abroad. Recognizing a coffee boom was looming, they opened their first shop in 2009. They've not looked back.
Now, it's worth me painting a picture. This is a two-story, there's a mezzanine level upstairs. A lot of wood, very nicely done inside. This would not be out of place in Sydney or in London or in New York.
That's the intention. A lot of Cambodians, they are willing to try something new. They want to expose to something cool, modern, or they see it in the movie or cable channel.
Tell me about the ambition for Brown. You've got 10 outlets now. How far can this go?
Our vision is to be one of the leading coffee shops in Southeast Asia. Our co-founder wants to show coffee drinkers that, or even tourists who actually travel to Southeast Asia, if they want a good coffee, then definitely they need to drop by Phnom Penh.
Brown Coffee's outlets, which serve coffee, other drinks and food, have different design concepts, part of the vision of creating a unique space in each. Setting up a roastery at this, their ninth outlet, was part of showing their customers how seriously they take their trade.
So we decided to invest in roasting. Before that, we roast our own coffee in Bangkok. The key of coffee is freshness of coffee. If you roast it here, then the freshness of the bean is very fresh. So it's good for us in terms of quality control.
Okay, so you're talking about the roastery, which is downstairs here. Mm-hmm. Let's go and have a look at it.
A bit noisy, but yeah, okay. Roasting now.
It smells fantastic, I must say.
Smell very good.
Well, I've never seen a coffee shop where you have a roastery and you have customers sitting on the other side of the glass panels drinking their coffee.
I saw it in Australia. A few coffee shops has done that in Australia. And I can see now a few other cities, Kuala Lumpur, they have it. It's very interesting, it's a new trend.
Introducing new trends is part of Brown Coffee's appeal, as I found out when I went to meet prominent young Cambodian Kunila Kao, a media consultant, blogger and master's student.
Brown Coffee's done a lot better than its competitors. Why do you think that is?
So besides the product, it's the design and the feel of the place. I can say it's a place where it is Midwest, the design and everything, and I think that this is what the young Cambodians want these days. They actually want to show off a little bit when they come here. If you come here regularly, you will see like really, really big cars parking in front of the cafe and cool kids showing off their iPhones and devices with each other. But there are also people who come here to work on their computers.
Do you think young Cambodians and Cambodians generally look at this and go, well, actually we support this partly because it's Cambodian?
Well, I think it helps Brown a lot, especially because they keep saying that this is a locally grown brand. And the second thing is, I think it inspires young Cambodians. I've talked to a few young people who come here before, and I asked them, like, why did they love coming here? They say it's the feel, it's the food, and it's the inspiration, and also the aspiration of the place that gives to them.
Looking ahead, Brown Coffee will open another 4 stores by the end of the year. 2 of them in the tourist capital, Siem Reap, home to Cambodia's famed Angkor Wat temple complex. Bunliang has regional and even global ambitions too. Meantime, Cambodia's economy continues to grow apace, says Bunliang, attracting increased investment from abroad.
And that's when Starbucks turns up.
Exactly. So we'll see how it goes.
Not worried about Starbucks?
I do. I mean, if I say I worry and then we did not do something, then it doesn't make sense. So sooner or later, Starbucks definitely will come. So we have to be ready for that.
A report there from Robert Carmichael, enjoying the sweet coffee aromas in Phnom Penh. Now on to the world of tech startups in Singapore. Bash is an innovative co-working environment funded by the Singaporean government, which aims to bring fledgling tech startups together with ambitious investors. Situated in Block 71, a precinct touted as Singapore's mini Silicon Valley, the facility brings together local and international entrepreneurs, providing valuable mentoring and funding opportunities. Our Singapore Bureau Chief Nolan Giles visited this sprawling creative space and spoke with Steve Leonard from the Infocom Development Authority of Singapore about the role Bash is playing in the island nation's grand ambition to become Asia's tech hub.
The key for us is less about how do we make anything happen and more how do we just try and provide some foundation and then more or less get out of the way. So our goal is not to try and make something as much as provide an environment like the one that we're sitting in together and then have all the industry people come in and do their thing. So some of the people that you've seen as we walked around are startups that are trying to get off the ground or experienced business leaders that are serving as mentors and coaches. All we're doing in this case is providing the place, and we also provide some of the funding where it's appropriate. But everything else, the organicness of the environment is really up to the community.
So let's talk about the organicness of the environment. Can you take us through a few of the facilities here that really highlight that?
Sure. So what we have is we have a place where investors and startups can get together. We have the sort of stadium seating where there can be pitch days. We have an environment where there's music that we can set up with bands, and we've got amps and speakers. We have the coffee machine spot. We have the beer drinking spot. We have all the things that a community needs at different times during the day. We also have fabrication environments where if people want to build electronics or work with different 3D printing machines, all those tools are available. We also simply just have a big ecosystem of experienced leaders that would like to help small companies get off the ground.
We just had a walk around before, and there's quite an international mix of businesses here. Mm-hmm. Can you take us through how you curate these businesses?
So part of what we do is just travel around. So I was in Berlin last week, I'm in Australia next week, I'm in London the week after that, in San Francisco the week after that. So part of it's just being out, and the team is out. So we have teams that are in Israel, teams that are in Europe most of the time. So part of how we build this ecosystem is just putting our hand out and saying, we'd like to be friends, we'd like to get to know you, and you should know us. So that sort of network effect continues to build.
And what's your pitch for getting, say, a young business in Tel Aviv? Why would they want to come to Singapore and set up here?
Well, in a nutshell, what we're asking people to do is to think of Singapore as a node on the network. So anybody that builds a company knows that it's a global market. If they want to build a big company, it's a global market. You can pick almost any example, and most companies that you can name are companies that have had to serve a big problem or a big industry. And so part of what we're saying is we represent the Southeast Asia demographic. We've got 500 million consumers that are within a 3.5 hour flight radius of where we are. Why would you not need to know and address that market? Number two is we're a rising demographic. There's more mobile use in Southeast Asia. There's rising affluence. It's a young population as a general statement in some of these markets. So, for example, Indonesia has a massively underbanked community, meaning there's many more smartphones than there are bank accounts. So there's a number of fintech companies, financial technology companies, saying, how do I serve people and their financial needs through their smartphone, as opposed to the traditional through a bank branch? So Singapore is where a lot of those companies are building to see if they can pursue that type of opportunity.
That was Nolan Giles there in conversation with Steve Leonard in Singapore. This is AsiaPac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. Up next, we're touching down for 24 hours in Auckland. Well, Well, we're nearly at the end of this week's show, but before we depart, let's touch down in New Zealand. Imagine for a moment that you've just found yourself in Auckland for a 24-hour layover. Some airports offer a world of distractions, others less so. Well, instead of improvising a pillow out of your bulging suitcase or attempting to freshen your face with hand wash, cold water and flimsy paper towels, why not use the time to see what the city has to offer? Well, we asked Monocle's contributor Simon Farrell-Green to give us a guided tour of his city.
After hopping off the plane, I'd have breakfast at Orphans Kitchen in the inner city suburb of Ponsonby. Orphans is an all-day restaurant run by two young guys, and you could really go here for dinner too, but it does some of the best breakfast in town, creative and thoughtful, like sardines with horseradish and brioche toast. From here, I'd take a mid-morning walk up Ponsonby Road, checking out a couple of shops along the way, including Flotsam and Jetsam, which sells fabulous industrial antiques, before walking down through Western Park, on the city fringe in one of the earliest parks in the city, planted up with beautiful old trees. From here, I'd grab a taxi over the Auckland Harbour Bridge to the seaside suburb of Takapuna, where I'd get a gelato from the Takapuna Beach Cafe and walk around the rocks left by an ancient volcanic eruption to the tiny but beautiful beach of Thorn Bay. This is my absolute favourite place to swim in summer, so be sure to bring your togs. For lunch, I'd head back to the city, to Odette's, a beautiful new restaurant and a former bus workshop at the City Works Depot, right on the edge of the city. The menu is casual and simple, and the space is just lovely. I'd carry on downtown now, to Britomart, a gentrifying area of 19th century warehouses down at the port, and there's some great shopping here, including a good collection of New Zealand designers, such as Zambezi and Kate Sylvester. Fuel up if you need with a single origin coffee at Coffee Supreme in the bottom of a 1970s former sailor's home. For dinner, I'd head uptown to Coco's Cantina, a raucous bistro in the middle of a former red light district, where the steak is some of the best in town and so is the pasta, but do leave room for tiramisu for dessert. There are no bookings here, but sisters Damaris and Renee Coulter and their team of waitresses wearing red lipstick will look after you. It's like visiting someone's slightly mad living room. For a nightcap, I'd head to Golden Dawn in Ponsonby. It's a pub, but it does fantastic cocktails, and there's an excellent selection of whiskey. There's no sign, and it's sometimes hard to get in, but just tell them we sent you. And for somewhere to sleep, I'd book into Hotel Debrett in a historic 1940s building with a mid-century fit-out. If you've got room for one more drink, the house bar here does a fabulous Negroni.
That was Simon Farrell-Green there, guiding us through the best of Auckland. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Asia-Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ. The show was produced by our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong and Singapore, and by me, Ben Rylan, here at Midori House in London. Nina Norick was our editor and Kurt Lynn was our researcher. Asia-Pac Unwrapped is back at the same time next week. That's 7 a.m. Monday in Sydney, 9 a.m. in Wellington and 2200 hours Sunday in London. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or tune in via iTunes, SoundCloud or the Monocle app. This is Asia-Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Until next time, I'm Ben Rylan. Enjoy your week.